This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
This is the Jesse Kelly Show.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show. Another hour of the Jesse Kelly Show on a wonderful, wonderful Monday. But we're setting aside all politics now because it's the start of the second hour on Monday. We're going to do Medal of Honor Monday. Then we're going to go back into the history of the Rhodesian Bush War. And look, we'll be back to politics next hour. There's all kinds of stuff we have to get to. Ukraine stuff, emails, the Biden administration, what they did with Social Security numbers, and more. But you know what now is? We find an American hero, someone who earned a Medal of Honor, and we remember his name, and we remember his deeds. And this is something I really want to encourage you to do this in your own life in some way. I didn't do any of these things. Trust me, I'm not that guy. I'm just reading them. Right? You can do this yourself. You can do this in your home. You can do this in your work, in your Sunday school, in your school. You can talk about these people. You can talk about Archie Van Winkle. Archie Van Winkle was born in Juneau, Alaska. 1942, he goes and signs up for the Marine Corps to go fight in World War II, and he does. Goes and fights in World War II. Okay? Comes back from World War II, survives, and gets out. Goes back to regular life, right? Then Korea kicks off. Archie Van Winkle says, well, I want to get down on that. Goes right back into the Marine Corps. And off to Korea he goes. And let's find out exactly what he did.
Honoring those who went above and beyond. It's Medal of Honor Monday.
For conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty while serving as a platoon sergeant in Company B in action against enemy aggressor forces, immediately rallying his men in his area after a fanatical and numerically superior enemy force penetrated the center of the line under cover of darkness and pinned down the platoon with a devastating barrage of deadly automatic weapons and grenade fire, Staff Sergeant Van Winkle boldly spearheaded a determined attack through withering fire against hostile frontal positions and, though he and others who charged with him were wounded, succeeded in enabling his platoon to gain the fire superiority and the opportunity to reorganize. Realizing that the left flank squad was isolated from the rest of the unit, he rushed through 40 yards of fierce enemy fire to reunite his troops despite an elbow wound which rendered one of his arms totally useless. Severely wounded a second time when a direct hit in the chest from a hostile hand grenade caused serious and painful wounds, he staunchly refused evacuation and continued to shout orders and words of encouragement to his depleted and battered platoon. Finally, carried from his position, unconscious from shock and loss of blood, Staff Sergeant Van Winkle served to inspire all who observed him to heroic efforts in successfully repulsing the enemy attack. His superb leadership, valiant fighting spirit, and unfaltering devotion to duty in the face of heavy odds reflect the highest credit upon himself and the U.S. Naval Service. How about that? Guy moved on and lived until 1986, and I don't know why I always thought this was cool, ashes scattered at sea. Had his ashes scattered at sea. Kind of cool. I'm not wrong about that, Chris. Kind of cool, right? Kind of cool. All right. So let's do just a couple minutes of background in case you're just now hearing it, which I doubt you are. So I already told you last Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday in hour two, I've been chronologically going through the Rhodesian Bush War, all right? Now, to set it up, it was a tribal conflict originally. The British came in, essentially colonized the place, turned it into a thriving, wealthy, wealthy country where you had to have, there were all kinds of restrictions on voting. And keep in mind, we're talking about 1 million, 2 million black Africans here, a couple hundred thousand Europeans here, yet 95% of the people who were eligible to vote were white Europeans. This is post-World War II. The world's chafing on that. Britain's chafing on it so bad, trying to get them to change it. Rhodesia flat out rebelled and just declared independence. They said, we're our own country now. We're no longer your colony. And this is at a time on the planet where the communists, especially the Soviet Union, Cuba, and China, they are training rebels and insurgents all over the globe to infiltrate, infect, and bring down any country that is not a communist country. And since the 60s, these guerrillas have been going into Rhodesia. Now, also keep this in mind, a couple things, as I mentioned. The world sold this whole thing as white versus black. All the liberal college professors and idiots in the media and politics. It was not that at all. White people and black people were working hand in hand in Rhodesia. More than half of the Selous Scouts, one of their special forces type units, more than half of them were black. The Rhodesian Light Infantry, hugely black. This is it's a complete lie to think it was white versus black. That's how the world sold it, as this Nazi state, apartheid. That's not how it was at all. And the economy was so good, especially compared to the other African countries, that other Africans, black Africans, had been pouring into Rhodesia for the employment opportunities. We're talking a very, very modern, wealthy, fantastic country. And the military, which is going to matter a lot because they're about to need it, the military was tiny, about 20,000, and excellent. These are young men who grew up in the outdoors. That automatically helps. Hunting, familiarity with firearms. They almost all of them had fathers who fought in World War II. Rhodesia was well represented in World War II, so much so that the British government had to tell them, please stop enlisting. No, no more. You stay, please. These are hardcore fighting men. There aren't many of them. There aren't many troops, and this is really going to matter for today. There are not many troops. There are not many planes. Half their air force was South Africa. There aren't many helicopters. They don't have very much stuff. And also going to be important for today, Rhodesia is enormous. You know, when I was a kid, my dad used to take me hunting all the time, all over Montana. Now, if you're in a big state like California or Texas, this won't blow you away. But if you're not, this may. We would get in the car sometimes, and we would drive 4-5 hours on the highway, and we wouldn't come close to being out of the state yet. 4-5 hour drive at 80 miles an hour on the highway, still not out of the state. Place is enormous. Montana is enormous. Rhodesia was actually a little bigger. Huge. It's a huge place. Now, the final recap, because today it matters, is our clock. Draw a circle on a piece of paper or in your mind. The clock matters. Remember, from about 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock, you have Zambia. All right? From 12 o'clock all the way down to 6 o'clock, you have Mozambique. Gonna be a problem. Now, from 6 o'clock to about 8 o'clock, you have South Africa. And South Africa is really, by this point, a huge reason Rhodesia is still thriving. South Africa is providing, like I said, troops. They're providing other things. And Mozambique, that country that is 12 to 6, they are currently run by the Portuguese. The Portuguese, according to virtually every account I read, their military was all but useless, completely useless. The Rhodesians didn't sound like they had any respect for them at all. But that wasn't what was important. What was important was Mozambique is on the water. Remember, Rhodesia is landlocked. Mozambique is on the water, and the Portuguese were friendly with Rhodesia. Thus, trade. Oil. Rhodesia is able to sell and trade its things with South Africa and Mozambique. And remember how small that fighting force is. That's a lot of border. You can't properly secure a border all the way around 360 degrees with 20,000 troops. It's just you don't have enough stuff. But they didn't have to. Remember, almost all of this communist guerrilla infiltration was coming from Zambia, that country that's up there from, 10 o'clock or 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock, if just the northwest. And Zambia has a big river on the border. So it was even easier to secure it. Look at the river, kill the terrorists when they're crossing the river, and you're good to go. But 1974 comes, and really, this was the moment Rhodesia was lost. It'll take years. We're about to fight our way through these years. But what happened in 1974 really screwed them bad. In 1974, the Portuguese lose Mozambique, and Mozambique becomes a hostile, terrorist-harboring country. That's a problem. Next.
This is the Jesse Kelly Show.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a wonderful Monday. Remember, you can email us, jesse@jessekellyshow.com, continuing our history of the Rhodesian Bush War. Previously, it had just been Zambia with these different guerrilla groups. And always remember, there are two different guerrilla groups, two different, ZAPU and ZANU. One group is backed by the Soviets. The other group is backed by the Chinese. And remember, they do not like each other because each group essentially comes from one of the two tribes that had originally been on Rhodesia, killing each other, enslaving each other, slaughtering each other. These two different commie groups do not get along. But no big deal. It's just Zambia, right? We've got Zambia covered. Then Mozambique falls in 1974. The Portuguese pull out of it. Apparently, they were quite salty about it as well. They did things like fill up the toilets with concrete. It was essentially exactly what it sounds like. Hey, I guess you don't like civilization. I guess we'll destroy the civilization we created for you. I'm sure you'll be able to recreate it, right? See you guys. And yeah, Mozambique didn't do very well. Mozambique, like I said, though, it essentially is 60-70% of Rhodesia's border. Their small force previously could handle a tiny border, essentially running border patrol. Now, what do? The terrorists immediately began setting up big camps in Mozambique. And so the Rhodesians, and they'd been doing this before too, the Rhodesians start figuring out they have to play offense, not just defense. You see, they had camps set up all over the country, military camps set up all over Rhodesia so they could do these quick reaction forces, which we will get into. But that's just trying to, stop the leaks when you find them coming in. You've got to go find these people in their countries. And they begin. They will launch, obviously unauthorized, massive military actions into Zambia, into Mozambique, trying to blow up these training camps, trying to blow up the supply lines, trying to do whatever they can do to kill the guerrillas before they come into Rhodesia, to deprive them of arms, to do whatever they have to do. For instance, here's a great example of it. And we're about to go over some operations here, which I'll get to in a moment. But for instance, I mentioned there's a port in Mozambique, and I also mentioned the Russians, the Chinese, they were involved in this, deeply involved, because they wanted to control Rhodesia after it fell. So how are those weapons getting there into Africa? Lots of them are coming by ship. The Rhodesians identified the port where the weapons were coming in through Mozambique, the Mozambique port. This is friggin' brilliant. In this port, they had a problem, you see. The port, it was where the river met the ocean, and I don't want to get too technical with this kind of stuff, but essentially dirt, I'll just call it dirt, starts to pile up at the bottom of the river, at the bottom of the port, and the port isn't deep enough, if that happens, to allow a huge ship to come in. So what they had was a boat that would dredge the bottom. It would clean out the dirt. And this is something you had to do often. The Rhodesians were just unbelievably good at these kind of super secret ninja special forces type missions. They got scuba divers into the port and they nuked the boat that dredged the river. The boat, dead in the water, now the river cannot be dredged. The bottom of it raises up so much, the port is dead. They can't get any more Chinese munitions into the port. But wait, there's more. They figure out that they're going to take their guns along this train. You know what we will do? We'll wait until the train is about to cross a massive train bridge. I mean, picture it. You can picture it in your mind. Over a canyon. They wait until the train is basically entering the bridge. And they nuke the bridge so the train doesn't have time to stop. The train, yes, it does have some civilians on there, but it also has tons of munitions that were going to be used to kill Rhodesians. The train cannot stop. The bridge blows up. Uh-oh. All the way down to the bottom of the canyon the train goes. And then, to pour salt in the wounds, the Rhodesians go down to the bottom of the canyon and steal all the guns and munitions so they have that. And remember, in case you're wondering why, with the fall of Mozambique, Rhodesia now has one friend. It's South Africa. That friend that's down there, but you know, from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock, South Africa. Remember that the UN, because of Britain, they have these crippling sanctions on Rhodesia. Now they're having a hard time economically because Mozambique's gone. They're having a hard time getting stuff in. Munitions, things like that. They can't get stuff. They are landlocked. They are completely dependent on South Africa. Without them, they have nobody. And South Africa is helping, don't get me wrong, but they can't do that much. So we'll talk about a couple other operations. One, it was a revenge operation. Revenge for what? Well, you know how communists can't control themselves? They've never been able to control their demonic impulses. Probably not a good idea to hand them anti-aircraft missiles where civilian airliners fly. Hang on.
Jesse Kelly.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a fantastic, fantastic Monday. Back to our Rhodesian Bush War. So I don't want to get too in the weeds on the details, but there is something that kind of matters for our purposes here. Remember I said that Zambia is that country to the northwest of Rhodesia. Mozambique is the country that's it's essentially their entire eastern border. The Soviet-backed guerrilla groups were really Zambia, right? In Mozambique, those guerrilla groups, that guerrilla group, they were backed by the Chinese. And they had two different types of war they were trying to fight. The Chinese, it's almost two on the nose. The Chinese were more focused on being subversive, being quieter about it, less technologically, but more spy stuff. Does that make sense? The Soviets, they had tanks. They wanted their guerrillas to be outfitted with heavy equipment. And one of the things they gave them was surface-to-air missiles. Remember the guerrilla groups, neither of them had air power at all. A huge advantage the Rhodesians had was they had excellent helicopter pilots, excellent fighter pilots. They had air power, the guerrillas did not. Seems like an easy problem to solve. The Soviets said to their guerrillas up in Zambia, hey, how about some weapons that can shoot down a plane? But communists cannot control themselves. There is a passenger airline. A passenger airline flies in the wrong place, and the commie guerrillas shoot it down. Now, it doesn't get blown up completely in the sky. Yes, of course, the explosion hurts and kills people. The crash landing hurts and kills people, but there are several survivors on the ground. Okay, sounds good, right? Well, Some of those survivors manage to crawl away from the wreckage, get somewhere where there's essentially some place to hide. Others are too tired, sick, or injured to do so. The ones who crawl their way into the bush and find a place to hide, they were the living witnesses of what happened next. The commie monster guerrilla groups that shot down the passenger airliner drove up to the crashed plane and promptly executed all of the survivors. The word would have never gotten out had there not been living survivors. Word got out. Obviously, word got to Rhodesia, and Rhodesia is furious. Now, up to this point, they had not really done cross-border things, right? Now they're going in. Cross-border things like the ship thing and the bridge thing. They hadn't really done that yet. Now they go in, and it's called Operation Gatling, where they attack three different guerrilla camps in Zambia over the course of 3 days. It's almost a simultaneous attack. Helicopters, planes, troops. Now, I need to clarify something about the troops. Because it's such a large country and there were so few troops, the Rhodesian troops were basically all of them airborne troops in some way. They were always parachuting into a place or getting out of a helicopter. It was the norm. You could hardly drive very, I mean, there was driving, don't get me wrong, but when they launched operations, they were always from the air, air operations. So they do a huge cross-border attack into Zambia. Now, what do communists do? What do communists do today and always when they get attacked, when they do something terrible and they get attacked, they play the victim. The communists, after this three-day affair, the communists came out and said, hey, you killed a bunch of innocent civilians. Rhodesia killed a bunch of innocent civilians. Now, I know you're probably rolling your eyes and saying that's ridiculous, and of course it is, except who runs the media today? Communists. Who do you think was running it back in the 70s? Communists. You know that communist governments around the globe, including in Western civilization, they hated Rhodesia, hated it. They were trying to get the place to stop. What I'm saying is the media, the governments, they were all too willing to believe the communist propaganda that civilians were killed en masse and the Rhodesians looked terrible. Now I need to explain something before we get into other things like torture and other operations and stuff like that. Fire Force. Really cool name, I know, but Fire Force is something the Rhodesians did, and here's what it was. Because of the size of the country, as I already mentioned, because of how many troops they had. How do you get everywhere when you find out there's been an infiltration of guerrillas? When they find 50 guerrillas, 100 guerrillas, they set up, I'll call them army camps, all over the country. All over the country. There would be, I'll just pick a number, it's going to vary, but 100 troops in one camp. Helicopters are there. Planes are there. Now, I mentioned before the group known as the Celis Scouts. It's really Celu Scouts. It's a French term, but I'm just going to call them the Celis Scouts because that's what most people know them as. The Celis Scouts were this elite unit where they tracked people. It's what they did. They hunted down guerrillas and tracked them. Also, kind of a cool little tidbit, did you know that more than half of the Celis Scouts were black Africans who were communists before and they recruited them and turned them and now they fought for the Celis Scouts? How about that? Really cool. Anyway, they did all kinds of things. They would pose as warlords and things like that. They would do all kinds of things, but their job essentially was to go find these guerrilla incursions into the country. And let's say they're out and they find one. They find a large group of tracks, they find trash, they find something. They track it and they find 50 guerrillas. 50 guerrillas who are having lunch in a riverbed. Beep, beep, beep. They get on the radio. This is what Fire Force was. They get on the radio and the closest camp of the Rhodesian military, the closest camp would mobilize. Boom. Troops, everybody. Get in the helos. Get in the planes. And the idea of it was this. Get to where the guerrillas are quickly And more importantly, they were trying to envelop the guerrillas. Why envelop the guerrillas? Well, the guerrillas had a strategy they used. Remember, it's easy to think about these guys as unsophisticated. They had all kinds of training from the Soviets and the Chinese, advanced military training. What the guerrillas would do when they were caught, they would disperse. Everybody would kind of go in a different direction, and then they would know, I need to get back across the border. Once I get back across the border, we'll reconvene and we'll be fine. The Rhodesians know this is what they do too. So the idea of fire force is mobilize the helos, mobilize the planes, mobilize it all, mobilize the troops so fast that you envelop them so they can't get out. You try to trap them and kill them all. Trap them and kill them all. By the end of the war, which we're not going to get to yet, but by the end of the war, the Rhodesian troops were basically worn down to the nubs because they would go on 2, 3, 4 fire force missions a day. Don't think you would get on the helo and go out and kill 50 guerrillas and then it's time for a beer at the local officer club. No. You went right back to base, maybe went back to base, maybe you went right from one fire force mission to another fire force mission all over the country, flying, killing, dying all day long, flying, killing, dying all day long. That was fire force, essentially a quick reaction force that allowed this admittedly wonderful Rhodesian infantry or military in general to quickly get to where the guerrillas are and kill them. And that's a good thing because the commies are now getting in more and more and more because that friggin' border with Mozambique is now open for them. The Rhodesians have to start taking other measures, if you will. Before we get to the other measures, one of them is actually, I'm about to give you the coolest, one of the coolest friggin' things I've ever heard in my life, speaking of the Sella Souths. Before we get to that cool thing they do, I want to talk to you about this. I want to talk to you about switching your cell phone service, saving some money. Why don't you give yourself a gift for 2026? And that gift is you spend half on your cell phone service next year that you're paying now. What would that mean? Average family saves over $1,000 a year. What are you doing with $1,000? Be nice to have a little extra pocket change, right? When you switch to Pure Talk, you switch to the patriotic cell phone company. You'll get to speak to a friendly American on the phone, a friendly American, because Pure Talk hires Americans. They have these incredible phones and phone plans, or you can keep your phone, keep your phone number. They make it easy, and it's easy to switch. We're talking switching during the break here. It's 10 minutes on the phone with an American. Dial #250 and say Jesse Kelly. #250 say Jesse Kelly. We'll be back.
Truth, attitude, Jesse Kelly.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show, trying to get through part 4 of the Rhodesian Bush War. I'm not going to be able to wrap it up tonight. I will wrap it up tomorrow. I don't even think it'll take me an hour. I could continue to go on and on and on. I know it's a fascinating thing, but we'll get back to politics here in 10 minutes. Remember, you can email the show, jesse@jessekellyshow.com. So it really is so impressive to me as I read through it, how advanced in the thinking the Rhodesian military and their spy agency was. I told you they now realized they had to cross borders and attack the guerrillas in their camps in other countries before they got into Rhodesia. You had to do something to kill them in their countries. And so they come up with something called Operation Dingo. Now, it would have been quite an ugly affair to watch it, but still so impressive. Here was Operation Dingo. Here was the idea behind it. Two gigantic terrorist bases. That's what they called them, terrorists. And essentially, that's what they were. And remember, these terrorists are setting landmines on Rhodesian roads, butchering farmers whenever they find them. They use terror tactics, bombing things. They're terrorists. Operation Dingo identifies two large guerrilla bases. Here's what they start doing. They start taking Rhodesian planes, jets, they're military planes, and flying overhead of the bases, over top of the bases. Why? They wanted the terrorists, they wanted them to get used to the sound of Rhodesian jets flying overhead. You know, at first, when you first fly overhead, the terrorists think they're about to be bombed or something like that. So they run and they hide naked into bunkers. But then you do it enough times, the terrorists start to figure out, wait a minute, nothing bad's going to happen. I don't need to pay attention to the Rhodesian jets flying overhead. I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. Operation Dingo was this. They loaded up all these troops onto planes with parachutes. Then, as per usual, they flew some of their jets over the bases. The guerrillas, you know, they're going to look up, but by now they realize they'll be fine. The Rhodesians knew when the troops would gather for formation on their base. They waited until the troops were at formation. Essentially, you're standing out in the open, and then they start dropping huge bombs on them and incinerating them. Napalm, you name it. Apparently, there were body parts all over the place of these communist terrorists because the Rhodesians caught them in formation. And as soon as, or basically as the planes are dropping bombs on the commie terrorists, the Rhodesian troops are jumping out of planes with their parachutes and parachuting down as the commie guerrillas are firing up at them with AK-47s, putting holes in their parachutes. The Rhodesian troops land, and this is where I'll get very frank with you. This war was fought in a way that may make you squeamish, uncomfortable, both sides. And it was a war that was barbaric because it had to be. The Rhodesian troops couldn't afford to take prisoners, aid the wounded. No. They walked around killing all of them. And they had identified the likely escape routes the guerrillas would use, and they set up a hidden blocking force so as the guerrillas are fleeing the base, they get mowed down as they run right into the Rhodesian guns. The Rhodesians are walking around, shooting guerrillas in the head as they're burning to death. It is a horrible, horrible, ugly affair that was awesome. An incredible military campaign and a huge success. But this is where I'll leave you for today, because tomorrow, I said Operation Dingo is one of the coolest operations ever. It's probably the one we will go into tomorrow, to be honest with you. But I'll leave you with this. Now and forever, what I'm about to say has been the case. Wars are not just military things. There is always a political aspect to every single war. Always. Alexander the Great, as he's out there conquering the Persian Empire, is constantly having to deal with politics and political intrigue back home. Julius Caesar, you name it. There's always a political aspect to every war. We like to imagine there was a time when it was just two armies squaring off like men, and we didn't have these pesky politicians. It's never been that way. Rhodesia was always doomed because the world was against them politically. And by doing the military things they had to do to win, they were actually increasing the public opposition to them. I find Operation Dingo to be an insanely impressive military campaign. The public did not. Now, it was in Rhodesia, don't get me wrong. They were quite happy about it in Rhodesia, but globally, America, the UK, it was essentially sold as a mass slaughter of civilians. They claimed there were all kinds of refugees in the camp who had been killed and executed. Internationally, this huge military success didn't land well. And now we're at the place in Rhodesia. Now we're in the 70s, the late 70s. They can't hold back the tide anymore of guerrillas. They've even put landmines along the Mozambique border, all kinds of landmines the Rhodesians have, but it was such mountainous, rough terrain, you couldn't possibly mine all of it. They're finding a way to get through. They are now regularly setting up camps. The Rhodesians are having to take steps. I just mentioned politically, that's why I brought this up. Steps like, remember those African tribal peoples who are still there? The Rhodesians are pulling them out of the reservations, the villages they'd put them in, and said, no, you can't stay there anymore. Now you have to come into the city. Because they can't have them being recruited by the communist terrorists who are coming in. It's a nightmare. A total nightmare. We will finish the Rhodesian Bush War tomorrow. Before we finish that, I want you to be finished with dog food. I take that back. Keep your dog's food. I get it. That's the food Muffy likes. But please add rough greens to your dog's food. Dogs do not get vitamins and minerals and antioxidants and omega oils. They don't get that stuff from dog food. Fred used to have a digestive issue every single time he would have a meal. Do you have any idea what that's like? It's freaking awful. He has not had one since we started him on rough greens. His stomach actually works the way it's supposed to work. He never has to go to the vet, ever, unless it's for some annual checkup thing, ever. Rough Greens saves you money on vet visits, and it'll keep your dog alive longer. You want a free jumpstart trial bag? You sprinkle it on your dog's food. RoughGreens.com, promo code Jesse. RoughGreens.com, promo code Jesse. We'll be back.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.